great. And the subtitle in the UK was The Case Against Religion. But in the States, when they know, they really know how to market things in the States. The subtitle in the States was How Religion Poisons Everything. Right, and everything you need to know about the difference between England and America is right there in that subtitle. In England, it's The Case Against Religion. And in America, it's How Religion Poisons Everything, right? Really, that subtitle captures the tone and the content of God Is Not Great. And I thought I'd share with you a quote from one of these great YouTube videos where Christopher Hitchens really lays the boot into religion to give you a flavor for where he is coming from. He is an anti-theist. He doesn't just not believe in God. He thinks that even if God were to exist, that would be a bad thing. And so he writes against and speaks against the idea that there might be any kind of deity. He's very glad that there is not such a thing as God. And so he said this in actually in a debate against his brother. Very interesting. Peter Hitchens, a believer in God. Christopher, not so much. Christopher said this in debate. He said, religion is a totalitarian belief. Do we have that up on the slide? Religion is a totalitarian belief. It is the wish to be a slave. It is the desire that there be an unalterable, unchallengeable, tyrannical authority who can convict you of thought crime while you are asleep, who can subject you to total surveillance around the clock every waking and sleeping minute of your life, before you're born, and even worse, and where the real fun begins, after you're dead. A celestial North Korea. Who wants this to be true? He said. Who but a slave desires such a ghastly fate? And I listen in, and kind of I'm with Christopher, right, at this stage. Because I just think, if God is like the being that he describes here, call me an anti-theist, right? I will join Christopher. I will write against, I will speak against such a being with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. Who wishes this God to be true? Well, not me, and not the Christians that I know. I have a stake in this question, does religion poison everything? Not because I have some kind of allegiance to the idea of a God. I couldn't give a flying rip about the idea of some kind of deity. That doesn't get me up in the morning. I'm not committed to the notion that there might be some kind of super being, a surveillance machine, a celestial North Korea. My heart does not warm to the idea that there is some kind of a God. I often describe myself as a little bit like the woman who has grown up all her life saying she's dead against the institution of marriage. I'm dead against the institution of marriage. And all throughout her teenage years, I'm so against the patriarchy, so against the institution of marriage. No, not going to do it. Never going to do it. And then she meets a guy, right? And against all her better judgment, she falls in love and she might even marry him, right? Why? Does she now believe in marriage? No. No, she believes in him, right? And he has converted her, at least to the degree that she's willing to be married to him, right? And this is kind of what I feel about religion, if you want to put it that way. In a sense, I'm dead against the institution of religion. It doesn't warm the cockles of my heart, okay? But I met a guy. And to the degree that I'm willing to be connected to him, then okay, you could call me religious. In that sense, yes, I want to be connected to this person called Jesus and this thing called Christianity. Yeah, but not because I have this wider allegiance to the concept of theism. Like, that's not really where I'm coming from. And it's not really where a lot of my Christian friends are coming from. It's that I've met a guy, and he's converted me, and he's even converted me to some kind of relationship with him that if you look from the outside, you think, oh, Glenn's religious. And sometimes I'll wear the label and sometimes I won't wear the label. But the label is not really where I'm at. Actually, it's the person of Jesus has converted me to the kind of God I think you can believe in. The kind of God who is not a celestial North Korea. So I'm going to agree with Christopher Hitchens on some things. I'm going to say, yeah, if that's religion, count me out. I'm also going to disagree with Christopher Hitchens, and I'm going to disagree with him at a few points. And one thing I'm going to say is that actually religion pervades everything. Religion, in a positive sense, I would say, pervades everything. It doesn't so much poison everything as pervade everything. And I mean that in a couple of different senses. First of all, I think the existence of God pervades everything. I hope you know this about Christians, but we don't believe that God is just like a super being out beyond Neptune somewhere. We don't think of God as this really important, really powerful, really intelligent alien life form somewhere in the cosmos who directs the affairs of humanity. God is not like Bigfoot. He's not like the Loch Ness Monster, right? Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster are these individuals within the created order, and some people happen to believe in them and some people don't happen to believe in them, but they make absolutely no difference to the created order. It's just that they happen to be an item within the created order. God is not like on the item list of things that you might want to believe in. And some people tick the box of believing in this item called God, and some people do not tick the box saying, I believe in this item. God is not like that. We exist to God the way that Juliet in Romeo and Juliet exists to Shakespeare. Okay? We exist to God the same way Juliet exists to Shakespeare. God is not one more item within the created order. Okay? Juliet might be on the balcony and saying, where is Romeo? Where's Romeo? Like, that's a perfectly valid question for Juliet to ask. Where is Romeo? And he happens to be in the bushes below her, right? But she can point to a certain point on the stage, and that is where Romeo is. Where's Romeo? I don't know where Romeo is. Where is he? Well, he's down there, stage right. Okay, that's where Romeo is. But if Juliet was on the balcony saying, where's Shakespeare? Where is Shakespeare? How would you answer her? How would you even begin to answer her, right? You see, Shakespeare is the source of her being, the source of her consciousness, the source of everything in her world. And as she asks the question, where is Shakespeare? You might be scratching your head trying to figure out how to answer that question. But it's not because there's a lack of evidence for Shakespeare, right? It's not because, oh gosh, it's a really difficult question. It's because, where do you begin? If Juliet is doubting the existence of Shakespeare, where on earth do you begin? And if you're not a Christian and you ask a Christian, right? If God exists, where is he? Where is he? Your Christian friend might start scratching their head, but they're scratching their head not because there's a lack of evidence. They're scratching their head because where do you begin? Where do you begin with the God who is not just a super being within creation, but who is the source of being beyond all creation, who is the source of you and the world and your doubts about this source? Where do you even begin? When Juliet says, where is Shakespeare, where do you begin? When you and I ask, where's God then? Where do you even begin with the source of being? The Bible says, in God we live and move and have our being. Acts chapter 17. In God we live and move and have our being. So there's a very deep sense in which religion, in a positive sense, religion pervades everything because the existence of God pervades absolutely everything. There's another sense in which religion pervades everything, and that's that religious attitudes pervade everything in your life. And maybe you don't like that idea. Maybe you think, well, no, I'm not religious. When people ask me on the census, what do you believe? You know, do you have a religion? Is it Church of England? Is it other? Is it Catholic? Is it? And maybe you tick the box that says none, right? And increasingly, more and more people are ticking the box that says none, which leads demographers to talk about the rise of the nuns, which sounds like the least scary horror film ever. It's like Return of the Florists and Rise of the Nuns. It's like, it's not very scary. But what they mean is the N-O-N-E-S, right? Those who, when they ask, what is your religion, they say, I don't have one. And maybe you tick that box, right? And I'm telling you that religion pervades your life. And you're thinking, well, no, it doesn't. So there's no sense in which I'm religious. Well, don't be so sure. You see, if I asked every person in this room a question that's really basic, a question like, do you believe in the fundamental equality of every human being in the human family? Do you fundamentally believe that we are all equal. I imagine that everyone in this room would answer yes, actually. I want to convince you just in the next minute that that's actually quite a religious belief. It's not something you can scientifically prove at all. And, you know, if I put on stage, you know, two people, and she is richer than her, and she is taller than her, and more beautiful than her, and stronger than her, and more intelligent, and you know, more athletic, and more competent, and I start going through all these different aspects, and this woman is definitely superior to that woman. In this, and then you say, yeah, but they're equal. What does equal mean? What does the word equal even mean if in every dimension of their humanity, you're saying, yeah, but actually she is better than her, right? When you boil down every single property that these two people possess, and you say that, yeah, she is superior to that girl, right? How do you say that they're equal? What does the word equal even mean? And you say, well, I guess they're equally members of Homo sapiens. And you're like, well, hence what? Like, what do you want to infer from that? Like, the fact that we're the same species, does that have any content to it? Should that move me in any way at all in how I treat that other person? And to say that there is an equality going on and that it is now beholden upon me to treat this other person in certain ways because of that equality, you cannot put that in a test tube. You cannot demonstrate that scientifically. It's a faith position. It's a faith position we all kind of hold. And I think historically we tend to hold it in the West because on page one of our founding document called the Bible, it says that there is equality. We are all made in the image of God, male and female, all equal in the eyes of God and in the eyes of everyone else. But it is a radically and fundamentally religious belief, actually, to hold that kind of thing. And actually, that's just one example of all sorts of things that you and I take for granted every day. Beliefs that we have that lead us to act out those beliefs in certain ways. There is a religious development and a religious aspect to everything that we do in our lives. So I don't think religion poisons everything, not if we're talking in this much broader sense. I think actually religion pervades everything. You've got a theology, okay? I don't know what that theology is. Maybe it does not include a deity. But that's okay. There are plenty of religions in the world that do not include a deity, right? Buddhism, Confucianism, all sorts of traditional Chinese beliefs. We could, you know, demonstrate that they are religious people, and yet they don't have a god in their thinking, right? And yet, you know, they are people of a certain religion, right? Religion doesn't necessarily mean you believe in a supernatural being. It doesn't for billions of people around the planet. So just because you don't believe in God doesn't mean you don't have a theology. You've got an overarching view of humanity, where we've come from, where we're destined, the planet, future. You have that. We've all got that. And maybe your theology is just that we've come from nowhere and we're headed nowhere. Maybe your theology is that we are biological survival machines clinging to an insignificant rock hurtling through a meaningless universe towards eternal extinction, right? But that is still a theology. And it will lead to a certain form, a certain shape of life. I would say that actually religion pervades everything. We've all got concepts of humanity, of destiny, of equality, of freedom, all these kinds of ideas that shape you and I day by day. You might think you don't have a religion. I would encourage you, think again. Because I think religion, in this broader sense, actually pervades everything. French philosopher Simone Weil said this. She said, no human being escapes the necessity of conceiving some good outside himself, towards which his thought turns in a moment of desire, supplication, and hope. Consequently, the only choice is between worshipping the true God or an idol. She's kind of driving home that same point. We're all religious in that much broader sense. We've all got some higher ideals to which our thoughts turn in movements of desire, supplication, and hope. And then she kind of twists the knife at the end and says, okay, so what is that greater thing? What is that greater vision that motivates you. It will either be the truth, or it will be a twisting of the truth. And what's it going to be? It'll either be the true God, or it'll be an idol, a fake God, right? And a Christian is just someone who says, okay, given that all of us have a theology of sorts, who is the God who we can really trust? And I would say, as a Christian, in Jesus, I've discovered a God who we can actually trust. A God who is actually worthy of our trust and worthy of our lives. I want to draw your attention to just one line that Jesus says. It's in John's Gospel, perhaps the most famous piece of literature ever written. More people have translated and read and heard the words of John's Gospel than anything else in human civilization. So I'd really recommend you getting a hold of John and just reading through this biography of Jesus. Slap bang in the middle of it, Jesus gives us a little introduction to himself. And he does the thing that you or I do in a party. And we're not meant to do this at a party. We're meant to be much more interesting as we introduce ourselves and ask people, you know. But it usually ends up with me just saying, oh, so who are you and what do you do, right? Which is dull. You're meant to ask them, you know, what is your grand vision for life? And if you could take only one item to a desert island, what would it be? And, you know, who would be at your dinner party of choice if you can only have six members? You know, you're meant to ask really interesting questions. We don't ask those interesting questions, do we? We just ask, who are you? What do you do? Right? But that gets us some distance, doesn't it, in introducing ourselves. And here is Jesus answering those two questions. Who are you? Jesus says this. He says, I am the good shepherd. You go, ah. That's interesting. And what do you do, good shepherd? And he says, well, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I love these two sentences from Jesus because he is recalibrating all our thoughts about what God is. Because when he says that I am the good shepherd, it is a really outrageous claim. Everyone listening to him was Jewish. They would have known the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. They would have known their Psalms. It's the book of Songs, a slap bang in the middle of your Bible. And maybe even if you don't know any Bible at all, you might know the words, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It's the famous 23rd Psalm, perhaps the most famous chapter in the Bible. And it puts front and center that the one who is the good shepherd is the Lord. And if you were to read it in the Old Testament, it would be capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, Lord, the God of heaven and earth, our creator. And so this is how people think of the good shepherd, the one who properly kind of feeds and protects the flock. God will be the one who properly feeds and protects the flock. And then Jesus shows up halfway through human history and he says, yeah, here I am. Ta-da, look at me. The good shepherd has arrived. I am the good shepherd. And he says it to a group of people, the Jews, who in one sense would be the last people to identify anything within the created order as God, right? The Jews would be the last people to say, oh, the creator of heaven and earth has shown up on planet earth. But when they meet Jesus, they must conclude that because Jesus keeps insisting on it. He keeps insisting that he is the God who is older than the universe. And that he'll wrap things up at the end. He keeps insisting that if you want to know who God is, he keeps saying, just look right here. Which is an extraordinary thing to say. You know, if we get into conversation after this, and I say to you, yes, I am the eternal Son of God. I am older than the universe. I can forgive all your sins. Don't worry about that. And if you want to know what God looks like, keep looking right here. Like, you would be dialing 999, wouldn't you? You'd be trying to section me in a flash, wouldn't you? Like, and here is Jesus coming into the center of human history. And he says to people on every page of John's Gospel that he is what God is like. And you think, well, that's audacious. It's also heartwarming, don't you think? That the God that all of us argue about has shown up in human history, and he's Jesus. And you're like, oh, well, that's good, isn't it? Because Jesus is the kind of God who comes and stoops and serves and suffers and bleeds and dies. And you think, ah, maybe that's a God I could believe in. In the same way, you know, the woman who's dead against marriage, you know, I could never find myself married to him. But she meets this guy. He's different. totally different, wins her heart, and she ends up connected to him. You know, maybe that could happen to you. Open up John's gospel and shoot up a prayer and say, Jesus, if you're the one, show me. It's a really dangerous prayer. Because that's what happened to me. That's why I'm a Christian today. I opened up, it happened to be Luke's gospel. There are four biographies you might know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I remember reading through Luke's gospel and getting halfway through and just seeing the towering personality of Jesus and his stooping love. And just thinking, okay, if God's like him, I'm in. If God's like him, I can trust him. And I found myself trusting him. I found myself calling him my good shepherd. And that was about 20 years ago, and I've never looked back since. Dangerous thing, opening up the Bible, you know. You open up the Bible, you have a look, you see Jesus is the God you can trust, and you find yourself calling him Lord. You find yourself calling him God. And you know, bad luck, you're a Christian. It just happens to you. It just sneaks up on you. And this is how you find yourself becoming a Christian. So Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And then he says something so interesting. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep, which is just stunning. He's just said, okay, I'm God. And you can imagine all the people being skeptical and saying, okay, prove it. And you think, well, how is he going to prove it? Is he going to snap his fingers and have a mountain blow its top and, you know, molten lava come out? Is he going to, I don't know, make a donkey tap dance and sing show tunes? What's he going to do to show people he is the God of heaven? He says, yeah, I am the God of heaven. I'll prove it to you. Watch me die. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I'm the good shepherd. Let me show you what the good shepherd does. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Wow. Jesus seems to think that in dying for us, he is proving his deity. How could that possibly be? Well, we've already thought about how God is the source of being. He's not just a super being. He's the source of being. He's like a fountain. And you think, well, where do you see a fountain most fully? You see a fountain when it is poured out. And where do you see Jesus as the source of life? You see him when he is poured out on the cross with every drop of his blood. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Well, there's a God you can trust, don't you think? So I think religion pervades everything. But I think in Jesus you find the gods that you can finally trust, you can finally marry, if you like. But then that leaves us, just with a few minutes left, that does leave us with a question that Christopher Hitchens wants to ask, because when he says that religion poisons everything, we kind of know what he means, right? There is something about religion, in its negative sense, that absolutely twists and warps this world. Blaise Pascal, who happened to be a great believer himself, he said, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. It's true, isn't it, though? It's true. Men never do evil so cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. And why is that? It's because if you think God is on your side, think of how that amplifies the tribalism of the human heart, right? We are tribal creatures, right? And I'm right and you're wrong, and that's how I'm wired. And now, imagine I'm right and you're wrong, and I've got God on my side. And you're devilish, right? Think of the wars that can ensue, okay? And it's true, you know, does religion cause war? Well, yeah, it does. But you can't go too far with that argument, does religion cause all war? Because it certainly doesn't cause all war at all. It causes about 7% of wars. If you read the Encyclopedia of Wars, Philip and Axelrod have edited together about 1,700 wars they chronicle, and they reckon about 123 are religious in nature. 123 is 123 too many. But to say that all wars are caused by religion is just historically inaccurate. Let's put it mildly. It's historically inaccurate to say that religion causes all war. 7%. 100% of wars are caused by humans and the human heart and that tribalism. But religion, as this parasitic thing, can latch itself onto the tribalism of the human heart, and it can crank it up into turbo proportions, can't it? And we see that. There's this great verse in the Old Testament where Joshua is encountering God. And he doesn't quite recognize that it's God he's encountering. And he says, "Who are you? Are you for us or are you for our enemies?" Isn't that an interesting question? It's in Judges chapter 5. He says, "Are you for us or are you for our enemies? Do we have God on our side or is God on the side of our enemies?" And God actually responds, "No." Isn't that great? That's a brilliant answer. "God, are you on our side or are you on their side?" God's like, "No." You can just imagine the facepalm moments, like, "No," right? "No." But when you think that God is on your side, then absolutely it can ramp up the evil in this world by orders of magnitude. So what do we do about that? Well, just think about this verse. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Actually, the Christian view is not that we are strong lions, right? Or soaring eagles or mighty oxen, right? The Christian vision is that we are sheep. Do you know how stupid sheep are? Like, sheep are really dumb. I was speaking about sheep to a church setting, and I talked about how dumb sheep were. And then actually a farmer came up to me afterwards and he says, "No, you were wrong about that. Sheep are geniuses at getting themselves killed." And he started telling me all these stories about the stupidity of sheep. And you know, if they get too much water in them, they just lie down and they can't get up because they're too heavy. You know, if they get lost, they can't find their way home. Even if you come to Flossie and you say, "Oh, I finally found you, my lost sheep. Come on, let's go, Flossie." Flossie just, like an idiot. Flossie is a moron, right? And Jesus actually says in that verse from John's gospel, "You and I are spiritual morons." And actually, if you come into Christianity, it's not that you're coming on to the winning side where everyone is strong and wise. It's actually you're numbering yourself among the spiritual morons who cannot sort themselves out. Christianity is all about that. We're all spiritual morons. And we can't save ourselves. And we need a good shepherd. We so need a good shepherd. He even had to die for us. That's how spiritually screwed we are. Okay, we are nonsense. We are rubbish. We are morons. And Jesus does it all for us. And do you think that has the potential to counteract the tribalism of the human heart? If you recognize that you're a spiritual moron, actually. Hopefully it does. That's not to say that Christians can't be total burks and idiots a lot of the time. We really can. But imagine how much worse we'd be without Jesus, right? Because in this story, we are not the heroes who kind of co-opt God onto our side. We are the ridiculous sheep who just need rescuing. So, yes, righteousness poisons everything. And by righteousness, I mean our sense of self-righteousness, our sense that I'm right and you're wrong, and I've got God on my side. That absolutely poisons everything. But true Christianity is not that. It's not that at all. True Christianity is, I am not righteous. I am a spiritually moronic sheep, and I need saving. I need rescue. And hopefully, when you take that message to heart, it reduces our capacity for hypocrisy and stupidity. Hopefully. That's the idea, anyway. So, that's my time done, really. I think religion in this broader sense pervades everything. And actually, you have to live a religious life in the broadest sense of the term. You have to have higher ideals. You have to live into those higher ideals. But I'd recommend that you look into Jesus, because I think if we're looking for a higher ideal, you can't go beyond Jesus. And then the problem with the world, righteousness, it poisons everything. That's absolutely true. I'm with Christopher Hitchens on that. But maybe there is a God. Maybe there is a Jesus who has come to save spiritual morons like you and me. And maybe that can radically undercut the self-righteousness of the human heart. If that's true, then I actually think Christianity might be the hope for the world. What do you reckon? Well, we're going to hand over for questions in a second, and Jeremy can lead you in this next bit.
Okay, come and grab a seat if you haven't already. We are going to start again with our Q&A. I've got quite a few questions here, but we will quickly turn to the floor for some questions. Okay, so here goes. First of all, many critics of religion say that it prevents inquiry, and inquiry lies. So, yeah, maybe you can have an accent debate later. An inquiry lies at the power of humanity. Instead, we follow a dogma, a set of prescribed truths. What's your view on that?
Well, historically, I mean, Christianity has led to the founding of schools and universities. You think of Oxford University. God, my guiding light is the, you know, the motto for so many of these academic institutions. And just think about what a university means. It's that there are these universal truths that can kind of unite and cohere and give you a vision of the universe, which I think is a profoundly kind of religious take on the world, isn't it? That, you know, think in scientific inquiry about people trying to look for a grand unified theory. Why are we trying to look for a grand unified theory? Doesn't that sound incredibly theological? Why should the universe be like that? Why should everything harmonize ultimately? And maybe you don't think everything does harmonize ultimately, but I would say that that actually undercuts scientific inquiry. If you don't believe in a kind of a rational harmony to the universe, that is not going to aid you in your inquiry, because you're not going to press into the apparent chaos of the universe to try to find a deeper order. But isn't that what rational inquiry is? And so throughout the history of the church, there's been this motto, faith seeking understanding, faith seeking understanding. We have these kind of faith commitments, but the faith commitments do not undercut the inquiry. They lead to the inquiry, because the faith commitments are things like, there is a rationally ordered, rationally comprehensible universe, and we are rational creatures who can somehow be in tune with the rational order that is out there and study the empirical realm out here, and that those things triangulate because there is a God up above and there are minds in here and there's a world out there that actually all cohere in this grand vision that is incredibly theological, actually. Mm. And so those kinds of beliefs are precisely where universities have come from, precisely where the scientific method has come from. So I would go against that. I would just say that actually there are some beliefs that kill inquiry. Right, and if you find beliefs that kill inquiry, you might be in a cult. But demonstrably, the foundational beliefs of the West, which are fundamentally Christian, have not undercut inquiry at all, but have founded schools, universities, and the scientific method.
Okay, great. Often when people think about religion, they often think that it's a divisive influence in our culture. And this person's asked, what makes your religion more right than others? But of course, many people might say, well, the whole idea that you think that you're right and others are wrong is in and of itself one of the reasons that religion poisons everything.
Well, everyone thinks they're right. Everyone does. Let me give you three encouragements to look into Christianity, as though Christianity might be the pair of goggles that fit, right? The pair of spectacles that help you to see reality in a way that truly fits. There are three things that I'd point to as unique to Christianity. There's a unique vision of God. We saw some of it just now. The unique vision of God that Christianity gives is the kind of God who would bleed and die even for his enemies. You don't get that elsewhere. You don't get that kind of self-giving, even for spiritual morons, at the very heart of what it means to be God. There are other religions who look on the idea of God on the cross as a total anathema, as totally repugnant, and yet Christians kind of, this is the hill we die on because it was the hill he died on, right? This is what we believe about God, that he is fundamentally self-giving love with every drop of his blood. I think there's a unique God to press into with Christianity. I think there's a unique hope to press into with Christianity. Those who believe in the Bible are the only ones who really think that there is a future for this planet and these bodies. Honestly, nobody else believes that, you know. If you're an atheist, you believe that we're all headed for death, your death, the death of the sun, the heat death of the universe. If you believe in many of the religions out there, the idea is that you get zapped away from planet Earth while the earth goes up in flames and there's no more earth and there's no more bodily you. In many of the religions of the world, you dissolve into the ocean of being, like a drop of water in the sea. But there's no continuity. There's no hope for your body or this world. The Bible gives you your one shot at hope for these bodies in this world. I think that's a unique thing that you can press into. And then there is a unique way towards that hope within Christianity. You might know that sort of idea of religions as paths up a mountain. It's a very popular way of conceiving of religions. It's not a very good way of conceiving of Christianity, because we don't think we climb up the mountain. We think God came down into the valley. That's kind of what we think. And actually, that's quite a unique thing about Christianity. It's not about the ascent of the moral ones up into heaven. It's actually about the descent of God down into the pit to be with us and for us. And that gives us a fundamentally different way of being religious, if you want to use that language. So there are some unique things about Christianity that I hope will encourage you to kind of press into it. And yes, there are lots of religions out there in the world, lots of worldviews. But, I've got a set of keys for the building where I work, and there must be at least 25 keys on the key ring. And I'm not always sure which key fits in the lock. But once I've found the right key that actually fits the lock and turns it and gives me entrance, I don't then try every other key. Because once I've found the one that fits, that's all I need. And I think when you press into Christianity, you'll find a unique God, a unique hope, and a unique way of life. And it fits. And I just encourage you to look into it further.
Okay, that's great.
It is saying that there is a truth, right? And therefore, if there's a truth, then there are other things that are not true. Yeah. But to say that every religion is equally true is also a truth claim. Do you know what I'm saying? To say that there is a way of looking at all religions and they are all, roughly speaking, the same kind of thing, but they just dress themselves up in different clothes, that itself is a truth claim. And those who believe that view of religious pluralism believe it, absolutely. The only trouble is that's an inconsistent belief. To believe in religious pluralism absolutely is to believe that there is an absolute sense in which everything is relative. Well, that doesn't work so much. So I would say that actually we're all absolutists on one level or not. You know, we all think we're right. Even if you think everyone is equally right, you think that way of viewing reality is the right way of viewing reality, and that therefore other people are wrong. And so I just encourage you to have a look at Jesus, who is the person who came into a world that was wrong, but instead of denouncing the world that was wrong or condemning it, actually died for the people who were wrong, who came to the stupid sheep that we are and actually gave himself in heartfelt love for them. So while Christians can sound very arrogant to say we think we have the truth, hopefully, with Jesus at the heart of that, it's a truth that doesn't make you condemn your enemies. It should make you more willing to serve and suffer for your enemies.
Okay. We'll have one more question here, and then we can take some questions on the floor. Why do you have to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and call yourself a Christian to live a moral life and be guided by deeper philosophical ideas? So more generally, why do you have to call yourself a Christian to be moral?
You don't. Lots of my secular friends and friends who are tick the nun box on censuses are far better people than I am, and maybe raising far nicer children than I'm raising, maybe far better citizens in the world than I am. That's not the Christian claim. But the Christian claim is that if you happen to believe that ultimate reality is self-giving love, and if you happen to believe that you, with all your flaws that you need to own up to, need rescue by the one who has shown you self-giving love, and that he has poured himself out for you and now sweeps you up into his life of self-giving, because self-giving is ultimate, if you inhabit that story, then that's hopefully going to help you be a little bit less of a Burke than you naturally would otherwise be. On the other hand, if you happen to believe that the way we've got to where we are is crash, bang, selfishness, 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 selfishness over billions of years, and here we all are, I think that radically undercuts your motivation and your vision for life that would lead to acting morally. You might do so, in which case you are acting far better than your beliefs ought to make you, right? If you believe that ultimately it is our selfish genes that are calling the tune, and you manage to buck the trend and give blood and donate to charity, brilliant. I'm so pleased. And you may well be much more moral than I am. But I would say that on a societal level and on an all of life level, if you ultimately believe that selfishness reigns, that will radically undercut your motivation for acting in a self-giving way. Whereas if you actually think that self-giving love is the very heartbeat of the cosmos because it's the heartbeat of God, I hope you can see that vision of reality might lead you to being not quite the spiritual idiot that you would otherwise be. Does that make sense?
Okay, time for some questions from the floor. I think we had some right at the front here to begin with. Why don't we start over here? Yeah, there's a microphone coming just over here on where I'm pointing. That's great.
Hiya.
Oh, and if you could just give us your name.
So my name's Katie. I just had a bit of an issue with the marriage analogy and the idea that for a woman who fundamentally believes that marriage is patriarchal, it's oppressive historically, and then to get married, you've got to be somewhat ignorant of these values. In the same way, to become a Christian, you've got to be somewhat ignorant of a lot of the oppressive nature of religious institutions. So I struggle to understand how falling in love with this man can so easily make this woman dismiss these values.
Great question. So, is the woman shutting her eyes to everything that is wrong with the institution of marriage in doing that, and how can she reconcile herself to that? And if that's what I'm calling Christians, if that's what I'm calling people to do, to become a Christian and shut your eyes to institutional evils, how can we possibly hold our nose and ignore all of that? And I think it's a kind of a give and take. And part of it is that maybe the woman was wrong about how disastrously misogynistic marriage was. It's possible. It's possible that as she comes to encounter this person in a love relationship, that actually it changes her vision from one that was just purely an outsider's perspective on an institution to one in which she is invested and can see maybe there are reasons for the institution. So part of the answer is that, and I think part of the answer is once you see who Jesus is, and once you see what it entails to have a relationship with him, then you might start to view the institution in a different way. You might start to view the institution as actually quite helpful as ways of organizing people together as a movement of self-giving love and going out there into the world, which is not the way that you would have thought about it before you met this person. But I think on the other hand, there are definitely things that have been done in the name of Christianity and with the brand Christian that are utterly repugnant and are worthy of us actually calling out and saying that was wrong, that should never have been. So to say that you're a Christian is not to wave away the Inquisition or the Crusades or witch hunts or any of these kind of institutional evils that have happened in the name of Christianity. And so partly what the woman does is say, actually, I've discovered that it's not actually about the institution, and so much of that stuff is nonsense, but it's not the heart of things. And part of it is her coming to see what marriage is in a new way because she's been won to him. Does that start to help?
Well, there's both thoughts and also a question. I don't know if you want to pick up on that.
Add on to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you can maybe in some world kind of dismiss the events that happened in the name of Christianity, like the witch hunt, things like that. But there are things in Christianity that are fundamental, that are in the Bible, which I think we can all agree are wrong, like homophobia. And that's within the Bible that clearly states that it's wrong. So how can someone dismiss that? How does that make any sense if you're going to be a Christian? That's cherry picking. That's choosing what you want to believe and what not to believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all our intuitions on what sex is and what it means, what gender is and what it means, I think they've been radically shaped by the Bible. So what I see in debates about sex and sexuality are various visions of marriage and relationships and sex and the body that have been incredibly Christian and incredibly biblical. So that, you know, I often say that the Bible is such an immense book, even your problems with the Bible have been given to you by the Bible. And what I mean by that is that the right desire to see that minorities are protected and never hated and never shamed and never diminished, never victimized, is a thoroughly Christian thing that was not seen in the classical world at all, was not seen in Greco-Roman culture. The elevation of the victim, for instance, within Christianity is thoroughly because of, we think that there is a God who was a victim for us. And suddenly the elevation of the little guy, the elevation of the marginalized is a thoroughly Christian thing. But there are also things in the Bible, such as the meaning of sex, the meaning of our genders, the meaning of our bodies, that is different to the culture that we're in. And I would say on that issue, this is one of those things in which maybe the woman before she got married didn't quite understand what that husband meant by that institution. And I would say that there is a story within Christianity in which the Christian worldview about sex and relationships and male and female makes sense, that it's a beautiful love story. I'm not going to convince you in the next 2 minutes, but I do think there is a grander story that says God is love, history is a love story, sex is a proclamation of that love story, that male and female have been given roles to demonstrate that love story out there in the world. And all of this is like huge 30,000 feet sort of stuff. But I think as you come in on the story that is a love story, I think you can start to see why Christians say the sorts of things that we say about sex and relationships and all that kind of stuff. You might not agree, but I think there is a grander story to be invited into in which these things can make sense. If it's a case of homophobia, I denounce and condemn all homophobia. To shame people in any of those ways is utterly wrong and unchristian. And if the church has been involved in homophobia, then I totally condemn that. But then we need to talk about what is the nature of sex and relationships at a much deeper level.
Okay, let's go here. Do you still have your question? Yeah.
So, funny enough, my name is Christian. and my question is, I'm just going to sort of ask you about some of the logic you put forward today. So you said humans are inherently spiritual idiots, mm-hmm. And inherently tribal, which I think I would agree with. Mm. So you've clearly presupposed that we can have inherent qualities. But then you've said that the only way we can know a quality is because it's been given to us by God or by religion. Why can equality not just come from some sort of inherent feeling that we need to treat others right? And the interplay between that is not between religion and our own lowly origins, but just between different parts of the human psyche, which come as a product of imperfect evolution. And furthermore, how do you or anyone else claim to know which is which?
Okay. Yeah, great question. So you believe that humans are inherently equal to one another and are worthy of all provision and protection and given the infinite value, which is great, and I want you in charge of my society. But I go across here, and here's a culture that says, here are some weak people, and we've discovered that if we actually get rid of them, we flourish and thrive like nobody's business. And actually, the protection of the weak has only ever been holding us back. And maybe that guy's name is Friedrich Nietzsche or something. But we want to become supermen, and we want to build a society that is not founded on that Judeo-Christian nonsense view of equality. We want to build that sort of society. Now, what is there between your society and his society that says that you're right and he's wrong?
No, I'm asking you, why
is it not some sort of inherent feeling we have to treat people equally? I mean, I think the question of whether we actually are or are not objectively equal is irrelevant. Why is the feeling that we need to treat other people correctly or equally need to come from religion or from God? Why can it not just be part of our psyche?
Everyone can have that feeling. It's just that other people can have lots of different feelings. And I spend most of my time online feeling superior to other people. And I see that lots of other people online feel very superior to other people and back and forth. So what is it to say that my feelings, in my better moments, my feelings that I am equal to this other person, they're equal to me, is to trump my feeling that actually I'm superior to others or others are superior to me? What if we're just dealing with human feelings, I don't think equality gets off the ground. I think there needs to be something more transcendent to ground it, because otherwise Nietzsche does his thing and you do your thing, and who's to say?
We can come back to both these in after the after hearing a few more. Like, we can talk about it afterwards. Go
on. Thank you. I'm Rodi. From your first question from the card, I do agree that there are some beliefs, maybe not conventional religion, trying to shut up people. And I experienced that. And also, like Katie's question about marriage, I got a module about feminism in my university. And basically, when I trained to make a case that religion protects women, then they shut me up because they think religion is fundamentally bad in any way. So certainly I don't agree that. And also you mentioned that there are some people, good secular people, atheists. Certainly I do agree with that point, and I experienced a lot of that as well. They can get some moral codes from different ways, and which can compete with the moral code from religion. However, there are some people who don't know how to behave them properly and endanger other members of society. So do you think religion should play a bigger role in society to promote this kind of morality and to make people nicer to other people and respect other people, also equality-wise?
So I think the question is saying, does religion have a role in kind of making us more moral and better people from a good of society perspective?
Yeah, I think it absolutely can do, but I do think that that's more a side product of what certainly the church is called to do. I think what the church is called to do is to tell the grand story in which there is a God of self-giving love who's bled for you, who's given himself for you, even in your spiritual idiocy, and takes you to himself to share in that life in the world. And I think one of the things that flows out of that story are people who tend to start to want to give of themselves to others. So I think there's a misunderstanding of Christianity that it's basically a rule book. But I think if you open up the Bible, you'll find that vast swathes of the Bible don't tell you anything to do at all. Far more it's telling you a love story. Far more it's telling you about a God who would move heaven to earth to be with you, who would go to hell and back for you. That's the kind of story that then changes people, and the morality flows from that. But I think it starts with the story that Christians tell.
Okay. Some more questions at the back. Why don't we go over to yourself, and then we'll come over there.
So when you mention about believing that everyone is equal and bring that back to religion, does that also account the passages of the Bible that say that men between a certain age is worth double the amount of a woman at a certain age? Mm-hmm.
So if we're asking questions about the Old Testament, I mean, it is, like I've just said, the story of the Bible is a story that has a shape to it, and a story that self-consciously takes people from a position where God works with Israel and says, because of your hardness of heart, I'm going to give you these kinds of laws, which were miles better than anything around in the ancient Near East of the day. but which were not the way that God intended for things to be in the beginning. Actually, the Christian story is a story that sort of has a shape to it. And Jesus even says this in Matthew chapter 19, that there are laws in the Old Testament that were given because of hardness of heart that were not the ideals that God had for the people. There is a shape to the story. And so Christians don't dive into the Old Testament and take a verse and try to apply it to 2019. That would be like, you know, jumping in halfway through the Star Wars story and you know, the Death Star is exploding and you go, well, why is the Death Star exploding? Why should people do things like this? This is dreadful. And no, it fits into a grander narrative. So with specifics about the Old Testament, I don't know any Christians who go into the Old Testament and take a verse and try to apply it to today. But it is about trying to take the sweep of the whole narrative where absolutely in the beginning, Genesis chapter 1, male and female are equal before God. A stunning thing to have on page 1 of this document. And then you come through into the New Testament in which Jesus Christ radically brings in an equality, not just for Jews, but for Gentiles. And there is no male, no free, no slave, no male, no female, no slave, no free, no Jew, no Gentile. All are one in Christ. But you've got to trace through the story in order to see that.
Then, okay. So just in that you're saying about laws in the Bible, directly after saying that kind of like the Bible isn't a you do this, you don't do that. Do you not think that's a contradiction?
No, because you've got to figure out who the Bible is telling people to do things to, right? As you read the Old Testament, you're overhearing a conversation to a specific people at a specific time. And the Bible actually tells you to read the Bible in different ways as you trace through the story. So just because the Bible has a commandment between this person and that person, that doesn't mean I automatically assume that I am this person and that I enact that law in that way. I don't think you read any literature that way, and you certainly don't read the Bible that way.
Okay. One more at the back there, and then I think we might have to, I've got one more question after that. Might have to close. Matt at the back.
Hi, my name's Matt, and thank you for your talk. Just two things. Firstly, I didn't quite understand your analogy to do with Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. So firstly, it would seem to me that rather than Juliet asking, where is Shakespeare, as humans we're asking, is there a Shakespeare? Is there a writer? And secondly, I guess your argument for looking into Christianity is that the key fits the lock, firstly, and it's this idea of, I guess, it sounds nice. And I guess I'm thinking that, you said in your talk that society is very based upon Christianity. And so if that's the case, then does it surprise you that the key fits the lock? What I'm trying to say is, I guess, is the lock molded around the key? And shouldn't the truth be, shouldn't we follow a truth that's based on evidence and not what feels nice?
Right. Yeah, great questions. So with the Shakespeare analogy, it should absolutely be based on evidence. But I think, in one sense, the answer to the question, where is the evidence for the source of all life, is where isn't the evidence for the source of all life? It's absolutely everywhere. In God we live and move and have our being. And so as you search for evidence, you're not searching for evidence like the evidence for the Loch Ness Monster, as though there's some part of the world that you'll just, there he is. But you'll be looking at far grander narratives. You'll be looking at questions like, why is there something rather than nothing? And why do we live in a cosmos and not a chaos? And how on earth did inorganic chemicals form into life? And how on earth did brains form into minds and consciousness? And where on earth do things like morals and human rights come from? All of these sort of immaterial concepts. And why is it that we're having a discussion between us? Here we are, minds, using reason and emotion and rhetoric and language and all these things that are thoroughly immaterial in order to discuss the world. And actually, all those things should start to make you see that the immaterial is the most natural thing. The immaterial, your mind, your consciousness for a start, is far more closer to you than even this chair, even the sort of the world around you. And that's just an example of the sorts of arguments for God's existence that you will use if you understand that God is more like Shakespeare and less like Romeo. On the question of why do I think that in the West, obviously, Jesus is going to fit the lock because I live in this Jesus-shaped sort of spot on planet Earth. It is interesting how global the Christian faith is. When you talk about other faiths in the world, they do tend to be concentrated in various spots around the world. And yet, when you look at demographics about Christianity, there's 20% are in Europe, and 25% are in South America, and 25% are in North America, and the spread is much more international. Which again, maybe that starts to make you feel like the key to the human heart seems to fit a lot of different human hearts. And you've never seen a more sociologically diverse phenomenon than the Christian church. I don't think there ever could be a more sociologically diverse phenomenon than the Christian church. It's traversed classes and races and nations and cultures for the last 20 centuries. It's been growing ever since Easter Sunday, and it was bigger today than it was yesterday. It'll be bigger again tomorrow and bigger again the next day. And the key that it's unlocking is not just Western hearts. At all. The key that it seems to be unlocking is hearts from every tribe and nation and people and tongue.
Fantastic. I don't know, before I close, I just wanted to give you another opportunity if you just want to leave us with one lasting thought, Glenn. I don't know if there's anything else you want to leave people to go away with or close.
Jesus is good. Yeah, he really is. And if he is not what God is like, then okay. You know, Christopher Hitchens might be onto something. But I just really recommend, why don't you shoot up a prayer and just say, Jesus, if you're there, show me. It's one of those no-lose propositions, right? If he's not there, he's not going to answer. But if he is there, wouldn't it be astonishing if God was self-giving love given to you with every drop of his blood? That would be amazing, wouldn't it? So why not put it to the test and shoot up that prayer and come along to these sessions that Jeremy's running.
Great. Thank you very much, Glenn. Why don't we give Glenn another round of applause? Thank you.